When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to a special bonus episode of Say Why to Drugs. Today I'm joined by Lydia Davenport and Professor Graham Henderson for this episode, who are both involved with Bristol Drugs Project. Drugs projects exist all over the country. They're partly there to help people who want to quit or cut down their use, so people who have problems with drug use. But Bristol Drugs Project is also really into harm reduction. I've been aware of them for a while, and so this little gap in the regular schedule seemed like a great opportunity to have a chat with them about what they do. So without further ado, let's say why to Bristol Drugs Project.
Say Why to Drugs with Dr. Susie Gage.
Yeah, we're rolling. And I'm really excited to be joined by two people heavily involved in the Bristol Drugs Project today, Lydia Davenport and Professor Graham Henderson. So, hi, guys.
Hiya.
Hello.
Thank you very much for coming and chatting to me. And really, I just wanted to know, what is Bristol Drugs Project?
Okay, so it's a drugs agency in Bristol. We see around 5,000 people a year. So that's anything from people who see themselves as having like a drugs problem that they may be addressing over a long time to people who might just pop in for a bit of advice. And there's about 120 staff and about 50 volunteers. So it's quite a big project.
And is it the kind of thing where people choose to come in and talk to you? And what sort of services do you offer people who come through your door?
The large extent of people that come through the doors have chosen to be there. Yeah, we offer all of the stuff that you would kind of traditionally expect a drugs project to have. So we do prescribing for people, opiate substitution therapy, so people that are wanting to come off opiates like heroin. And we do structured group work, so kind of supporting people to change their behaviour around their drug and alcohol use. We support people with alcohol. So whether wanting to control it or stop drinking and have an alcohol detox. But we also do kind of things that I guess are less associated with a traditional drugs project, like we go out to festivals and clubs and give people advice about what they're using. We kind of do short sessions for people who are wanting to stop using something, whether that's powder cocaine, cannabis, tobacco. So we do kind of a big range of things, and we also have like an LGBT service, things like that. So we try and cover kind of whatever somebody might want help with around substance misuse in Bristol.
So it's a drugs project is a kind of thing, and there are lots of them that exist all around the country.
Yeah, there's loads of different types. I mean, ours has a harm reduction focus, so we don't try to kind of, we don't have a specific philosophy apart from evidence-based and wanting to reduce harm and supporting people to change kind of whatever their goal is. So some people that might be becoming abstinent, for a lot of people it might be just getting a bit more control and feeling like they've got kind of more options around what they're doing with their drug or alcohol use.
And Graham, what's your involvement with the Bristol Drugs Project?
Well, a year or so ago, I was invited down to come and talk to some of the clients and just tell them about how the brain works and how drugs work in the brain and what changes might be induced by taking drugs. And just people who are on drugs and in therapy really want to understand what's going on in their brain. And so I just try to help out with that.
Excellent. Oh, it seems like a great relationship then between the sort of the drugs project and the academic world, because you're part of Bristol University, is that right? Do you want to tell us a bit about your day job?
Yes, my day job is to teach students how drugs work, many drugs, different types of drugs. But my research interest has been for a long time in how opiate drugs work, both in the treatment of pain and in the induction of dependence.
And what's the sort of opiate use patterns like in Bristol? Is it a drug that's a particular problem or particularly heavily used?
Yeah, there's quite a high level of heroin use in Bristol. I mean, high in the sense of nationally, it's one of the places where there's the most heroin use. And there's also a specific trend in Bristol where people use heroin and crack together, which is kind of not as usual throughout the country. But then it is kind of, there's a thing, there's a lot of discussion at the moment about heroin being an ageing kind of drug taking population. So people using heroin, it is kind of gradually getting smaller as those people kind of grow older and less young people pick it up. But it is still quite a big thing in Bristol, yeah.
I mean, nationally, the number of people who died from overdose declined over about a 3-year period. But that just coincided with a time when the purity of the drug really came down. Mm. And in the last couple of years, the number of deaths has shot back up again. Mm. So there is a problem nationally about overdose deaths. Mm.
I was reading about a new nationwide initiative to try and get, was it naloxone?
Mm-hmm.
To get people who know a user to be able to sort of teach them how to do these kind of injections.
Mm.
Is that something that Bristol Drugs Project have been kind of involved with trialling or anything like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, we are a big fan of naloxone. So we, over the last few years, really have been working really hard to get naloxone out. So anyone that is on methadone or Subutex, so their opiate substitution therapies, we will prescribe them some naloxone. We trained loads of kind of hostels and homeless shelters and places like that so that people are just ready to do that. And also we kind of train family and friends of people in treatment so that if they come across an overdose, they're able to reverse it, because nobody should die of an opiate overdose. It's reversible. And we also kind of get called out in the local vicinity of where our agency is to deliver the injection and bring someone back to life, which is quite amazing.
So, Graham, how does naloxone work in that sort of, how can it bring someone back to life?
Well, naloxone blocks the action of heroin by just simply occupying the site in the brain that heroin would work on. So just heroin can't get on anymore. And it is really amazing when you see somebody who's completely, you know, breathing about once or twice a minute and blue, just a dose of naloxone and they just come straight back up again.
That's incredible. But it doesn't have the same sort of effects as something like heroin.
It's no, it has no effects.
Yeah.
So if you just give naloxone to somebody, nothing happens. It just blocks the action of heroin. So you have to have the heroin there to see any effect of naloxone.
That's amazing. And that's, I guess that's the kind of thing that a drugs project can do. Are there any, like, specifically Bristol-type drugs or sort of things that you guys have had to deal with specific to Bristol in your drugs project?
Yeah, I guess there are always kind of trends that come up in certain cities, and although they might be kind of part of a national trend, maybe Bristol sees them first or they've become a problem. So ketamine was like a huge thing in Bristol in the late 2000s. It kind of disappeared for a while and seems to be coming back kind of anecdotally. But there was a real problem with people taking ketamine. They were coming into the project and reporting lots of problems, dependency, physical issues to do with it. And it was kind of a case at the time that there wasn't loads of academic research and there wasn't loads of practical harm reduction advice about it. So it was kind of quite interesting, but it was a case of like gathering the intelligence that clients were kind of bringing, really listening to them and really kind of like exploring with them what was going on, and then kind of taking it to researchers and different places like that to try and get some good advice around it. So a lot of people have heard of the Bristol bladder, or the kind of the effects that ketamine have on the bladder, and that was something where people at BDP were seeing all these people coming in with that were quite young and otherwise quite healthy, taking a lot of ketamine, and they were having these kind of cystitis-like symptoms, lots of pain when they urinated or needing to go to the loo loads and loads. And kind of people were putting it together and saying to other workers, have you got like 2 or 3 young men with like this problem around urination. And then we realised it was a bit of a thing and went to the BRI, which is a hospital in Bristol, and spoke to the urology department, and they were just incredible. And I think we linked up a bit with the university as well to kind of find out what research was already going on and what was known. Used all of that feedback to take back to our clients and say, okay, we're starting to understand what's going on. These are some things that can help. But it was really a case of like trying to listen to the clients and hear their experience and flag that up to GPs in the hospital, because they had no idea why they were seeing so many like young people with bladder problems.
This is amazing. See, I love the joined up thinking of working, sort of seeing the people who are using the drugs and then speaking to the sort of hospital and the researchers and trying to join up all the dots to create an idea of what these substances are doing. It's just, it's music to my ears.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
So very recently, I was down, about 2 years ago, I was down at BDP and one of the care workers asked me why the heroin addicts in Bristol were now starting to take two drugs called gabapentin and pregabalin. And now gabapentin and pregabalin were first of all introduced as anti-epileptic agents, but they were quite useful in people who had chronic pain. But nobody had ever realised that they might be abused drugs. So we sent a researcher down to interview heroin users at the Needle Exchange Clinic at BDP, and asked them, you know, what they thought about gabapentin and pregabalin and how they used it and so on. And we discovered that they thought it enhanced the effects of heroin, but also that it would make heroin more dangerous. So we came back to the lab and studied that under control conditions, and it's true. And so it is a problem. And we've just had the figures out for 2015. There were 140 sudden deaths, drug poisonings, where the coroner discovered that gabapentin or pregabalin was involved. And of those, 80% were also using heroin, or heroin was in the blood. So there is a real problem there. And I think that was a very good example of BDP spotting something really early on, and so that we could become involved in researching
and try and work out sort of the science behind what was actually going on. So I guess what I was also really interested in is how you deal with kind of new drugs that come up. And I guess this is, we've sort of touched on this already, but things like the last two episodes of the podcast have been about synthetic cannabinoids, so things like spice, and then synthetic cathinones, so things like mephedrone. What's the first sort of thing that happens when a new drug kind of appears on the scene, or is... Do you notice it quite quickly?
We notice it quite quickly. We have like a lot of clients that kind of like early adapters, I get, like people that kind of pick up on drug trends quite quickly. We are really keen on listening to people about what's going on. So like we'll always kind of try and keep up to date with academic research and also in contact with other agencies across the country and internationally. Like, what are you guys seeing? Are you seeing anything new coming up? So spice is a good example where, so that's a synthetic cannabinoid. And we were seeing like loads of people coming in with all of these symptoms. We just had no idea like what was going on. And we tried to do some research and it turned out really nobody had any idea what was going on. So we quickly got together kind of focus groups where we would invite clients in, say, anyone using spice, come down on this day at this time, and we'll facilitate a discussion. So at that stage, it's just asking people, what are you experiencing? Trying to figure out if there's any general trends, because there could be things that people are experiencing for other health reasons or, you know, other medication they're taking. So it's not an exact science at that stage, but just trying to get people in a room. And we were figuring out there were some things like fitting and kind of much higher anxiety and things like that we were seeing. So then again, we'd be feeding that back to hospitals and GPs, just saying, keep an eye out for this stuff. What are you guys seeing? And now there is a bit more research coming out about it, which we're able to kind of match up. But we use that really just to give us an idea of possible best practice. When you don't know, when there's no solid evidence yet for what to do, we just try to kind of use general ideas of harm reduction, ask the clients and come up with something that seems sensible and suggest that. And that's what we did around spice.
And I really love this as well, because it's something that I've noticed as I've been putting these podcasts up, that the people who know the most about these substances tend to be the people who are using them, which I guess shouldn't really be a surprise. But it's also really easy for myths and stuff to grow up alongside that. So it's really great to have the combination of asking the people who've got the most experience, but then also applying the scientific method sort of to that.
Because you hear all sorts of things that totally, you know, not true. Mm. And myths definitely grow. You know, there's, you kind of talk about them in your podcast. There are all sorts of myths about, you know, ketamine and spice, really any drug. Mm. And so, especially when there's a bit of like media panic about things going on, it's quite hard initially to figure out what really is an effect of the drug. So we try and be really careful at the beginning about not buying into a panic, and just remembering that whatever the specific harm reduction advice you're giving, the kind of mechanisms of addiction and behaviour change and misuse are often the same, whatever the drug. So we still try and work on the stuff about, you know, not taking risks unnecessarily, and like thinking about whether people want to change their behaviour or they're happy as they are, that kind of thing, rather than getting into a big flap about what people are worrying about and, oh my God, is this going to happen?
Yeah, I was down at BDP talking to people, and somebody said, so why is it that if you take heroin, you become tolerant, so you have to take more, you know? But then if you go through detox and come off, if you start the heroin again, so that's like the second time, then the tolerance develops really, really fast, much faster. And this is something I'd never heard anything about. And you can kind of think, well, maybe it's just that they're more experienced, they take bigger doses the second time or so on. But we've looked at this, and actually there is a biochemical change in the brain that the second time you take the heroin, having come off it and had a period of when you've been withdrawn, then the tolerance really comes on really rapidly. And what we really want to know is, what's that due to? Because everybody who goes through detox at some point will relapse, you know, because the temptation to take the drug, the memory of it. Right? But what you really want is that for them to get no effect when they relapse. So sometimes they give them something like naloxone, a longer lasting version of naloxone, to try and block that out.
Naltrexone.
But if we could induce this process such that it was already switched on, that the tolerance was there, and right, then when they take the drug again, they wouldn't get any effect. And I'm so really excited about studying that. But then I would tell you that nobody in my position throughout the world, scientists studying heroin, has ever heard before that tolerance developed faster the second time. But these guys all knew it.
And that to us was like, of course, that's everybody's experience. Like, that was kind of like a common knowledge thing, which is why it's such a like amazing thing to kind of make that link.
Yeah.
So almost like the kind of like folk wisdom, almost like the things that people learn that we know, and that's kind of a given in the kind of drug using community or treatment community, can then get explored. And also there's real possibilities there for kind of medical treatment in the future, and developing new ways of supporting people in their recovery, which we wouldn't have come up with, obviously, without researchers.
Because I must admit that I assumed that the first time using heroin after a break would be extremely dangerous for not being tolerant, and therefore you'd run the risk of overdose.
Yes, yes, that we knew about. Mm. But the idea that then if you managed to get through that and take another couple of doses, that you would become tolerant very quickly. Mm.
And I guess if you could then induce the tolerance immediately, then you would prevent the risk or minimise the risk of overdose as well. So another benefit. To bring things sort of right up to date now, there's been lots of reports in the media about MDMA being an awful lot stronger at the moment than it has sort of been historically. Is that something that you guys have noticed, and have you got sort of ideas of how to help people to deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's been something we're really concentrating on at the moment, and quite like solid sources like the Global Drug Survey, Fiona Meacham and The Loop. People have really seen that there is a much kind of higher purity about at the moment. We go out to festivals like we did Love Save the Day and Tokyo World and stuff like that this
year. Festivals in Bristol.
Sorry, they're in Bristol, yeah. For about 2 years, 2014 and 15, we went to Boomtown, and we used that as a place to just ask people loads about what they were taking, what the effects were and things like that. And we were really noticing that people were taking like half a tablet of ecstasy and like feeling the effects much, much more than they would have previously. And we were also just quite worried that people were taking what they were used to taking. You know, someone that might have taken ecstasy a couple of years ago, go to a party or a festival and decide, oh yeah, I'll get, you know, have a pill, would take a pill and then just be like having a really unpleasant experience. You know, again, it's just about getting messages out in a trust worthy way to people and in a way that they understand. So, yeah, we have these stalls at festivals where we just chat to people and kind of explain things like that. We have an Instagram and we have a lot of slogans, which are pretty cheesy, but start low, take it slow, don't be daft, have a half. Learn before you gurn is one of my absolute favourites. Because, you know, people often like don't really know what they're doing or what they're taking. And it's a bit of a byproduct, I suppose, of drugs laws and of a lack of conversation about drug use. And there's also quite interesting stuff about discussion and research coming out about whether women's tolerances are different to men's for MDMA and things like that. So we just really encourage people to, you know, do a bit of research themselves, check pill reports, things like that, because I think it is, you know, especially since fabric closing, and there's been some deaths over the last year for MDMA, kind of more than before. It is quite an important message, and it's just as well about like not being a buzzkill. Like most people take pills because they want to have a good time. They don't take them because they want to be gurning in a corner or like feeling really unwell. So instead of focusing our harm reduction advice on this is how not to take risks, this will go wrong, we try and focus it on, you know, how to get the maximum pleasure out of your drug taking experience. And that is to kind of focus on, if you do this, you're probably going to have a better night, rather than don't do this, you might die.
Bad things will happen. Yeah. It's all about the framing of the message.
Exactly.
To use the sort of scientific terms.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the risks as well around drug taking is that you feel like you have to keep up with your peers or that kind of thing. So to have the message actually out where the people are likely to be taking the drugs makes it a lot more easy to sort of keep it in mind when you're actually in that situation where someone's in a bathroom offering you something or that kind of thing, rather than saying at home, yeah, fine. But once you get into that situation and it's your friends and you don't want to look like a buzzkill, I guess.
So
I think that's really great that you're actually there. And you mentioned the loop there, and I think people probably will have heard of that, but maybe not necessarily know that much about it. And so what you do at festivals isn't quite the same as what they do at festivals, is it? So what do they do?
They do kind of pill testing or drugs testing. So there's kind of like a legal line you have to walk. So I think the loop manage it in a certain way so that they're not doing anything illegal. And it's kind of with the festival or wherever they are in the police's kind of understanding. But they will take a little bit of a drug that somebody's given them and test it. And then they will come back and say to the person or kind of say anonymously, whoever handed this thing in, this is what it's got in it. And people then have the decision to make whether they are going to take that drug, go ahead and take it, or whether actually it doesn't really look like that's what they want to be taking, what they were expecting, or it's pretty high dose, so then they'll take a bit, you know, a bit less than they would have. So we don't, I mean, that's something certainly we would really love to do. Turns out the drug testing equipment is pretty expensive. So that's our main barrier. But it's an incredible thing they do, because they also deliver like a brief intervention or some advice there. It's not just about saying to people, yeah, this is what it's got in, have a great time. It's also about like delivering like a reasoned kind of bit of advice with it. If you were to take that, you'd want to make sure you were, you know, sipping a pint of water an hour, and you know, that kind of thing, giving them some solid advice rather than just telling them to kind of crack on.
In the Netherlands, this is available in many towns and cities, and you can put something in, and if you're planning on taking it at the weekend, and then get good detailed information back about what's actually in it. Whereas here, apart from the loop, there's really no other way
nothing.
You can.
Yeah, and it's really difficult because people will come up to us in a club and say, oh, my friend's got these pills, do you know anything about them? And like, even if somebody says, you know, at the moment, you know, there'll be a certain pill that we'll have heard, oh, that's got like 300 milligrams of MDMA in it. So if you, you know, if you see that pill, take a quarter, you know, start low with it. But, you know, there's no guarantee that just because one pill is kind of packaged or decorated in a certain way, branded, there's no guarantee that that is you know, that there's no quality control here.
Yeah, no regulation whatsoever.
No, so we can give that advice, but ultimately we don't, you know, we don't know if it's got the same kind of makeup as other pills that have been tested in the Netherlands and things like that. So that's why we have to give people that advice about taking a really small amount, doing things like testing a batch in a safe environment, taking a small amount, making sure there's friends there to to check on you, like maybe somebody not take it just so they're about to keep an eye on everyone. But yeah, if there was a kind of more in-depth way or just a more kind of responsible way of testing in the UK, that harm reduction advice would be a lot more specific.
Mm. It's not only the amount of the MDMA, but in some of them you don't even know what's in it at all.
Yeah,
and there
could
be lots of other things that are pretty nasty.
Yeah. Mm. A fascinating thing that we have found is how many people will take a mystery white powder. 2014, I think it was, we did a questionnaire with people at Boomtown Festival and just asked them, what have you taken in the last year? What have you taken in the last month? What do you regularly take? And we found, I think it was 11% of people said they regularly take a mystery powder that they have no idea what it is. So there were a whole other percentage of people that sometimes do. Mm. But I mean, if you think, and that's people that admitted it to a drugs worker, like a lot of people are regularly taking something, you know, packets found on the floor, being offered a dab by somebody and not knowing what it is. And things like that are, you know, kind of worrying because you just don't know what you're getting. You don't know what drug it is. You don't know what potency it is. And you don't know, like, what is mixed in with it, anything like that. But that, you know, there is a huge culture of just being out and on it and wanting to take whatever you can kind of get your hands on.
Which might also be related to the fact that even if you are told what a white powder is, that's not necessarily what it is anyway. So
right.
Maybe your idea of that it being more of a risk if you don't know, actually probably you still don't know anyway,
yeah.
if you've been told.
Yeah.
So maybe the risk, sort of idea of relative risk is sort of harder for someone to decide because of that lack of information anyway.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of, you know, there is no safe, totally safe drug taking. We can try and give people good, solid advice mm-hmm. to make it safer. But like you have to acknowledge because of, you know, partly because of the nature of drugs and partly because of people not, you know, being able to test or know what they're taking. Like there is never a guarantee that what you're taking is what you think it is. And that it's going to have the same effect it had, you know, last time you got it.
Yeah. But I also like that as part of Bristol Drugs Project, you do include alcohol in there. It's not just illegal or illicit drugs. Alcohol's regulated and yet people can still have problems with it as well. So
totally.
As you say, no drug taking is safe, but there are ways to sort of minimise harm.
Yeah. And it feels really important to kind of acknowledge the role that alcohol and even tobacco can have in people's, you know, certainly like the harm it can cause individuals and family. And actually, it's kind of nice in the groups that we run for some of the groups, like the really structured, more long-term ones. People are in a group with other people who may have an alcohol or a drug addiction or have some history of misuse there. And it's kind of nice because a lot of people from really different walks of life with really kind of different types of substances they're taking will really identify with each other. And so that kind of artificial barrier maybe that we have about alcohol, that's safe, that's okay, drugs are really bad, that kind of gets broken down a bit, which I think is pretty important.
Absolutely.
I think it's really only the government that try to distinguish between alcohol and drugs
mm-hmm.
because to people who work on drugs, alcohol is a drug.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
And all the studies that have looked at relative harms of drugs, alcohol has come out quite high. Maybe not as high as cocaine and heroin, but alcohol is pretty harmful.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. In that landmark Lancet paper by David Nutt and colleagues, alcohol, if you include harms to the self and harms to society, alcohol topped the poll. Admittedly, that was slightly driven by harms to society, but it's pretty high harms to the self as well.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you guys so much for coming to talk to me. Do you want to just tell everyone sort of how they can go about getting in touch with sort of either you guys or perhaps, because obviously people aren't just listening in Bristol, so how does one go about sort of finding a local drugs project and getting in touch?
Yeah, so you could either do a bit of Googling for where you are. If you go to see your GP, they'd always be able to point you in the right direction. For Bristol Drugs Project, like most agencies, we have a website. We also have Facebook and Instagram, Start Low, Take It Slow. And I think it's really good for drugs agencies and projects to be on things like this, because I think a lot of the time people think that you don't have a drugs problem unless you've got a really heavy heroin addiction or you're a full-blown alcoholic. And most, you know, drugs agencies are really up for having discussions about people's drug use whether that's, you know, cannabis, ketamine, whatever you're taking. And you don't have to like wait until it's like a huge problem. You can just have a kind of discussion if it's starting to cause you a few problems. So going to your GP, Googling, having a little look about what's in your area are usually the best ways to find out. Yeah.
Excellent. Cause, yeah, I imagine some people probably wouldn't want to talk about it with their doctor, where they might first want to go and talk to someone like you guys at Add a Drugs Project, where they might feel a little bit less sort of medicalized, I suppose. So get on Google seems like good advice.
Yeah.
Cool, awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And there we go. As always, if you listen on Acast, there are links to Bristol Drugs Project website and some of the things that we talked about in this episode. I hope that we'll have the next lot of individual drug episodes beginning in 2 weeks' time, so watch this space. In the meantime, I've put calls out on Twitter and on Facebook for any myths that you've heard about the drugs that we'll be tackling in the next batch, so do get in touch. And I'll see you next time! You've been listening to Say Why to Drugs with me, Dr. Susie Gage. The music and editing were by Jim Murray. The artwork is by @MyNameIsAd. Say Why to Drugs would not have been possible without the generous support of I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, the Medical Research Council, and Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces Network.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.